welcome to Andy from Charlottesville.
Hi, everybody. I'm Andy. I'm an alcoholic. Hey, Andy. Oh, and it's Zoom too. Look at this. These guys look great. You can't even see them, man. So I'm an alcoholic, and my sobriety date is March 21st, 2007. And I have a sponsor, and I have a home group. It's a common solution group in Charlottesville. We meet at 7:30 on Thursdays. So if you're ever in town, please come see us. And I do want to say that, and a lot of people say this, but that's what I really mean. It's an honor to do something for Alcoholics Anonymous. Billy asked me to come share my experience. It's an honor. It's something I have to say yes to. And I'm grateful to have the chance to do this. I'm grateful too, because I get to leave my house. Driving up the road here, I'm thinking, well, I don't get out of town much anymore. You know, with this virus shutting everything down, it's really changed the way that I move within the world around me. And it feels good to be with you people. Zoom's awesome. I see you there, James. But nothing replaces, I think, us being in the same room. So I'm an alcoholic, and in the first meeting of AA that I ever went to, I said that I was an alcoholic. But there's no way that I knew what that meant. I couldn't know what it meant to be an alcoholic at that point. I didn't know anything. I just knew that my wife had left. I knew that the world was coming down around me. And I knew something was wrong, you know. And when I say that I'm an alcoholic today, you know, what I know is that what that means for me today in my experience is that I suffer from a spiritual problem we call a spiritual malady. And it is the easiest way I can sum that up is it's self. It's selfishness. It's self-focus, self-obsession. It's worrying more about how I feel at any given time than how I'm affecting people around me. You know, everyone else's needs pale in comparison to my feelings or how I think something's going to affect me. And so what's really weird today when I think about alcoholism, that's what I think about, you know, and it's totally different than what I came in with. But there's obviously this big alcohol piece in the middle, and that's what got me in the door here. And so I'll share a little bit about that. I grew up outside of DC area, Northern Virginia, and you know, I had a pretty good, great childhood. I had loving parents, loving family. You know, I had parents that wanted to help me and teach me the right things. I don't know if I could ever listen to them. You know, I went to church, and actually something Billy said one time in a meeting in Buckingham, he said, this was my experience as well, was that, you know, I went to church all the time, and they might've been saying great things, but I couldn't hear any of it. And that was my experience as well. You know, I went to Sunday school, I went to church, but I never established a relationship with a power greater than myself. You know, the extent of my relationships were really with me. That was it. And, you know, I drank maybe a little bit in high school. And the reason why was just because it was kind of the cool thing to do, you know. Hang out, sneak out, break some rules, do some things, and didn't get in much trouble. Ended up going to college down here in Charlottesville. And, you know, the really, like, the big experience that I had, the white light alcohol experience for me was like that first day that I remember after I got dropped off at college for the first time. And I had this feeling like I'm there's no one looking over my shoulder anymore, you know? And I remember that first night, some older guys came around to the first year dorms and were inviting us out to a party. Very excited by this. So I went and I found all of the, a lot of the people that I knew from high school that came to college. And I gathered them up and went to this place where they're having a party. And I probably was like 30 minutes early, you know, really not cool. But I just wanted to be there. So I had everybody there. And I can see it very clearly. There was a big deck that was like ground level, like literally maybe 6 inches off the ground, but really expansive deck with rails all around. And I remember kind of like, it's probably like six of us that were there that came. And I remember sitting there and immediately this like kind of fear swept over me where it was like, I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing here. Like, I'm not, this isn't like my house where I came from. This is, I'm looking across the deck and I see these guys and they, maybe they're 2 years older than me. Maybe they're three, but they seem like they're 40 years older than me. You know, they look completely different. And I don't know what to do. And I don't know where to put my hands. And you know, I don't know how to talk to anyone there. And like all the parties, then they had these giant rubber gray trash cans with the keg dropped down in there with the tap. And then there's like somewhere there's an upside down stack of red plastic cups. And so, you know, the whole time I'm just kind of silent and I'm just pumping and drinking and pumping and drinking. And, you know, still looking around and being bewildered. There's something I heard Clancy say one time. He said that alcohol made him feel the way that men look. And that's what happened to me that night, is that I looked at these guys across, and to me, these were men, you know, and I wasn't, that wasn't me. I was just some kid. And I'm sitting there drinking this beer. And what I notice is that I'm not caring about like where my hands are, you know, and I'm not silent anymore. I'm talking. And then like the people around me are laughing, you know, and I'm like telling jokes and they're into it. And then it's like a lot of these faces are like girls and they're really interested. And I'm talking, and then some of those guys from across the deck, they're the faces that are here, and we're having a good time. And the feeling that I get is, I have discovered me. Like, this is who I am supposed to be. And I had been missing the little ingredient that's going to make me unlock and be who I'm supposed to be. And so for the next several years, I basically everything I wanted to, I did was to get that feeling again. And when that's the focus, school's not the focus. And so at some point the university let me know, we don't, you should come back next year, you know? And so at that point I had to go, I lived with my parents for a year. Again, at the time, never thinking anything of it, but you know, I would imagine in their life plans, they had kind of thought they were done with raising kids, you know, at that point. But, you know, I just plopped myself down. There I was again. Anyway, I got finished up. Eventually, I got back to school, finished that up, lived with a girl that I met in college. And, you know, eventually we got married and we lived out in the country in Gordonsville. And, you know, I worked in town. And so it was a lot of commuting back and forth. And thing I remember is that there was a gas station that every day when I would be leaving town, I would stop and get 2 22s. And it was just the perfect amount to just drink. And I'd take dirt roads all the way home. You can actually take dirt roads to get to Gordonsville from Charlottesville, like over that little mountain. And, you know, eventually those turned into 240s. And, you know, eventually I was drinking so much beer just on every little car trip I'm on them. I'm throwing up foam like when I get out of the car, you know, it's just a craziness. We eventually got married out in Crozet, and the time we lived in town, it's kind of scary. I don't remember driving us home, but apparently I drove us home from that wedding, which is just a sad thing to think about, but we made it. And then this place I was working for, it gave me an opportunity to work from home. Which is, if you're an active alcoholic and you can work from home, it really opens up a lot of opportunities. And, you know, I really got into kind of a rut. And the thing was, it would be about 3 p.m. and I'd been in the basement working all day, maybe a few hours, but I would say I've been working all day and I would just need a drink. And now I knew my wife was going to be home maybe by like 5. So I'd say, let me just go get a beer. So what I'd do is I'd drive up to the gas station and I would get a 12 pack. But what I would do is I'd get 2 12 packs. So I could drink the first one and then just drink the first beer out of the second 12 pack. I'm very crafty. And I know that when she smells beer, I can be like, oh, I just had this beer, you know, from this 12 pack. We talked about this for years after. She never realized. And meanwhile, in the garage, there's this like mountain of cans and cases that are growing. But she said she never realized. But what she did realize is that, you know, when you're drinking like that, and then your wife comes home, like you never can really have a real relationship, real connection. And what it was like when she'd come home, it's like the brakes slammed on. And I have to be very aware about how I'm drinking, you know? And really what I'm doing is I'm just waiting until that point when she's not there looking over my shoulder so I can drink the way I want it. And I would, you know, inevitably we'd have dinner, maybe we'd have a fight, whatever. And then she'd go to bed and she just want me to come to bed, not for any romantic reasons, but just more like a safety thing. Like she wanted to see the light switched off. He's done. That's it. I couldn't do that, you know? And I would wait and I would sit in my chair watching TV, and I had it positioned so I could look down the hallway we had in our house. And at the end of the hallway was our bedroom. And she would sit in there and she'd have the door closed and she'd read in bed. And I could tell because under the little crack under the door, you could see the light coming out and it would spread like 8 inches out in the hallway. I could see it. And so I'd be sitting there and I'd be staring and I'd look and I'd see that light on and I would just be like, boom, she's still reading. And I'd look and I'd see it's still on and I'd just, boom. And eventually I'd look and the light would be off. And this is the moment that felt so good. I just, oh, she is asleep. I'm a free man now. And I would get up and I would go to the refrigerator, the cabinet, and I would put bottles in my fingers. And I would always try to spread them so they wouldn't clink together. I didn't want to wake anyone up like she'd hear anyway. And then I'd elbow my way outside onto our porch. And I'd just sit and I'd drink. And I don't think I was drinking at anyone I'm angry at. I'm not drinking. I'm just drinking. And I drink to oblivion. I drink to where the light goes out and I black out. The next thing I know, I'm waking up. And I have that moment, which is, it's almost like before your eyes peel apart, you know, you're like, where am I? What did I do? You know, did I hurt anyone? Did I hurt her? And then it's like, I cannot believe that I did it again. You know, like, how does this keep happening? And I would have this moment of complete clarity. And probably the most honest moments of my life occurred right at those moments when I'm waking, coming out of that blackout. And I would tell myself that I won't do this anymore. And I would say it for a good reason, not because this isn't good for me. It's because I'm hurting the people that I love. You know, the people who love me, I'm hurting them. I don't want to do this anymore. I'd want to not do it for the right reasons. And I would make this promise that this is it. I'm not going to do this anymore. And I would get up and we'd have whatever fight we had to continue having based on what I did that I didn't remember the night before. She would eventually go to work. I would get up and maybe get some greasy food, try to soak some of that stuff up. Maybe go do work for about an hour. At some point around 11 a.m., I'd have a real sweat where like everything would come out of my pores and everything. It was just gross, but I'd feel better. And then I'd work real hard for a couple hours. And then it gets to like 3 o'clock and I'm eyeing the thing. I know she's gonna be home in 2 hours. And I'm like, I'm just gonna go up to the gas station and get 2 12-packs. Just have, you know, and it's like, boom, this whole thing over and over again. And so eventually she had enough of this cycle. And she said, I'm gone. You know, I'm out of here. I'm going to go to my mom's house. And I thought that was a little alarmist, thought it was an overreaction. Because I had not drank before. I'd like put my foot down and like not had to drink for a week. And you want to know the most miserable guy to be around is a guy that's an alcoholic before he's found a solution and he's not drinking and he's the designated driver at like a wedding. So I could go, and I was asked because I was not drinking for a couple weeks, and I'd be the driver. And so we're at that. They got married. They said their vows. Rings popped on, and I'm basically like, let's go. You know, and everybody's like, well, we got a reception to deal with here. And so, and of course, I'm sitting there just angry, miserable, you know, pounding the table. And so I had not drank. Like I had proven I could not drink. Now, that's not somebody you want to be around, but that's what I'd done. And so anyway, I felt like this was an overreaction. So I needed like a Hail Mary play. And so she's coming up the road here towards her mom's house. And I called, they used to have these things called Yellow Pages. There was actually a number for Alcoholics Anonymous, and I called it. And I talked to somebody at the Charlottesville office, and they pointed me to a meeting. And it was a Friday night. And so I figured, well, I've put the fire out. I've solved this problem. So I called her on her phone as she's driving up. And I said, it's okay. I'm going to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to go to an AA meeting. Don't worry about it. Basically, like, whip a Yui. Come on home. And she said, you know, good luck. You know, good luck. And she kept going. And I didn't think that was the response I got. Anyway, so I go to this meeting. And this is the point where I go to this meeting and I say I'm an alcoholic. Now, how would I know what that is, right? But something happened in that meeting where I felt like a connection. I felt a sincerity and a true honesty. It's like when you hear somebody talking to you and they're not getting paid to do it, and they're just telling you about their own experience, and you can be, you know, that guy is really just telling you the truth. And when you have a whole room of people doing this to you, it really connects, especially if you're that kind of guy. And I felt that connection there. And I was a little overwhelmed by the hands that reached out, like people who wanted to help, you know, it was a lot. So I started going to these meetings. I had to keep it up because I'm trying to get her home. You know, this was like a long con I'm playing, you know, to get her home. And, you know, it worked. Eventually she did come home, and I'm still going to these meetings. And everybody's saying in the meetings, you know, what they say now, you got to get a sponsor. You know, you got to get a home group and all of these things. And something about that just seemed a little hokey to me, you know. Meanwhile, we're meeting in like church basements. And there's like things up like this that just seem, oh, they seem okay. They seem pretty simple, like a sheet of paper, you know, to solve this complex problem that I'm bringing to you guys. Like this is, how could this solve all of this stuff? Doesn't make any sense. And it's free, right? You get what you pay for, right? So I just knew there were so many things wrong with me that this seemed too simple. I've heard people say in AA, they say Alcoholics Anonymous is a simple program for complicated people. My experience and the truth that I'll share with you is I believe Alcoholics Anonymous is a simple program for people who think they're complicated. And that was me. I'm always coming up with ways why my problem's a little bit different than yours. It's a little bit more complicated. Like it's a little more important too. You know, it's like all of these things. And my grand sponsor refers to that as being terminally unique. Right. And I didn't get that early on in AA, but I know what that means now is that I think I am so different in this situation of being different and unique is terminal to me. It will kill me. That seems like hyperbole, but my experience has been what I've seen in Alcoholics Anonymous is that that's what kills alcoholics. It's when people cannot get this solution because their case is different. And I identify with that. I know that too. I know that there was a period of time when my case was so different. So whatever you were selling or offering for free is not going to work for me. I'm too complicated. And so I'm going to these meetings and I get a sponsor. And what I do is I get this sponsor and I figure out he's very structured. And he's got these certain meetings he goes to every week. So I go to the other meetings so I can dodge him. And I spend all my time figuring out his schedule so I can go to the other ones. But what's good is I'm at the other ones and I'm still the new guy. And they're like, hey, do you have a sponsor? I'm, oh, yeah, I got it. Don't worry, I'm covered. You know, it's this guy. He doesn't go to this meeting. So don't worry about me. And I think I join a home group during this process. But what I do is I just kind of roll in from the parking lot right as the meeting's starting. And it's like you say the prayer and you drop the hands and I'm like, gone. My sponsor's asking me to do things like call 3 alcoholics a day. I really don't have time for that. He's saying things like I need to get a commitment in the home group. And I got to tell you, at that time, too, I would say I'm not an expert on alcoholism, but I really don't see, seriously, not a joke, I don't see how making coffee is going to fix an alcoholism issue that I have. So I didn't really have time for it. And so what happens is I really create this extended period of that like designated driver period where I'm not drinking, but that's all I'm doing. And what that looks like is around my home with my wife. I can't have a conversation without wanting to punch a hole in drywall or break something or just, you know, tear somebody's head off. The way this looks at my workplace is that I'm telling the owners of the company that I work for that they just don't know what they're doing. They don't know how to do this. This isn't the right way. You know, I'm becoming unemployable. I can't basically drive to the grocery store without wanting to kill someone. And I'll be honest with you, that still happens to me occasionally these days, but life is not manageable. It is so much suffering. Just to move around without a solution. I wouldn't put that word on it, but that's what it was. And where this got really clear for me is I'm in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and this guy says something that I am pretty certain he'd probably said 100 times that I had been in a room, but it's like those things in AA. It's like, they say something. And it's like, okay, they say something. It's okay. And then 100 times later, somebody says that same thing. And it's like, whoa, that's what you were saying this whole time. I didn't get it. And so we talk about the gift of desperation. I think that that's what happened to me is that I was so coming apart at the seams in every aspect of my life that for whatever reason, I was able to hear something for the first time that had been said many times. And what the guy said was, for an alcoholic, alcohol isn't their problem. It's their solution. And he said, if you take alcohol away, things aren't going to get better. In fact, they might get a lot worse without a sufficient substitute. So I don't know why, but in that moment, everything clicked into place. And what I thought was, maybe I'm just an alcoholic. And maybe I've taken the one thing out of my life that has ever made me feel comfortable in my own skin and expected everything to be great without any replacement. And I started looking around the room of people and realized that they're not all pretending to be happy just as a joke on me. They're comfortable in their own skin because they have a replacement. They have a sufficient substitute for alcohol. And so that's when my life, my entire life got very simple. Call up my sponsor, and I got completely honest with him. And I became sponsorable then. We sat down and we read out of the big book together and we started taking the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I guess that's probably the day I really got a sponsor, as opposed to having a sponsor just in name only, so that if you ask me, I could just tell you I've got a sponsor. And so now I'm perfect. And that's the end. Not the case. You know, I learned a lot of things in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I continue to learn, you know, every day. And, you know, one of these experiences that I had, and it's kind of wrapped up when I think about the fourth and fifth step, where we take an inventory, we write down about these, you know, the resentments we had, what it affects. And this thing, when I'm talking with my sponsor about these things, you know, he made it very clear to me this focus on this fourth column, this last piece we put on our inventory when we're looking at our resentments. And it's where we got the ball rolling. You know, what did we do? And That was really frustrating to go through this process with someone who held me accountable for looking at my side of the street on those things. And it forced me to get, at least intellectually, in this position to understand that if I'm angry, if I'm upset, there's something I'm doing either to put myself in that position or to hold on to it or to cause someone to react a certain way. I was accountable. And so that was something that I learned going through that, sharing it with my sponsor. And I feel like I learned quite a bit, but like everything I've experienced in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's like putting these things into action is where it really cements itself in my life. And so in my experience, the program is when we go on and we do the 6th and 7th step, and then we go do 8 and 9, and we make amends. We make amends for a lot of these things we started bringing up in that 4th and 5th step. You know, now it's like the rubber's meeting the road, right? We got to take all this intellectual knowledge that we've learned about ourselves. We got to go do the right thing. And the amends process for me was really, a game changer. I kind of thought that the purpose of the amends, I'm bringing to this thing everything that I had, my own experience before Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought the reason you say I'm sorry is so somebody will be like, it's okay. Like, you're good now. All right. I want you to tell me you like me now and I'm okay. And there's no longer a problem. You know, it's about what I'm getting out of it. Otherwise, why would I do it? And so it's frustrating to work with a sponsor who's really kind of focused in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, because he would always focus me when we were doing step 8 and preparing to go make amends on what is the harm that I have caused, right? And I'm not going back to say I'm sorry to anybody, and I'm not going back so anybody can pat me on the back and tell me I'm a good guy now. I'm going back. So there's been a scale where I've taken something from somebody, I've hurt them, and I've tilted this scale. So the purpose of this amends is I need to go back and right that sucker the right way, but I don't know what to put here to do that. That's why I need to make amends with this person, and they can help me say to fill in the blank, what can I do to make this right? It's not about, they might still hate me afterwards. That's not the point. Right? I have screwed up all of the spiritual balances all over the world when it comes to my interactions with them. In this amends process, I'm trying to right those things. Now, it was my experience in doing this that almost all of them were really great experiences. Right? So that was a byproduct that I'm really happy to share with people, especially guys that I work with about that. But the only reason that happened is because that wasn't why I went into it. You know, I was focused on what is the harm and what can I do to make that right? So my sponsor gave me this list of things to think about. It was like a checklist for my first amends. And it was like, 1, pray. 2, call sponsor. 3, tell them how you've harmed them. Ask them if you've left anything out. And then he had this next one, which was be quiet. He might have said shut up. And then he said, ask them what you can do to make it right. And then again, shut up. And here's the thing. He must have thought I was an idiot, because this is a simple list. And he wrote it down and he wanted to review it with me over and over again. And I'm just like, I get it. You know, I understand. And so I remember going to my first amends, and it was my first one with my sister. I did a couple amends, and I was kind of leading up to this amends I wanted to make to my family. And I remember my mother, specifically my father. And I remember going to sit down with my mom, and I remember being in the driveway and having this realization. So I was in the driveway of her house in Northern Virginia, and I couldn't remember the last time that I had driven there and ended up there sober. At some point on the mileage between where I lived and there was always a stop where I had to get something to drink. And I never showed up at her house sober. So that's the first thought I had. I'm in there. So I prayed, asked God for willingness. I called my sponsor. He You reminded me of the checklist, the little step-by-step thing again. And I remember sitting in the car, and the last thing I wanted to do was to go in and to do this thing with her, because I didn't want to get into it. And I really, like, in every example in my life, I look back, it's at that moment, that's why I drive away. Like, why do it? But for whatever reason, right at that moment, I opened the door and I walked up the walk to her house and I went in. And I honestly believe that this is a moment I can point to where it's like a higher power. God is doing something for me that I cannot do on my own. And I just believe that. That wasn't me walking into the house. I look back over all of the experiences. I have the evidence. I don't do that. I relied on a power greater than myself, AA, God, my sponsor. And that's what I did. I went in. And so I go in and I tell her how I had harmed her. And my sponsor helped me kind of synthesize this down so that she would know that I know how I've harmed her. And so I laid it out for her. And then I got to that next part, which was, tell me if you've left anything out. And it was like Billy had called her ahead of time and prepped her that I was going to ask this question, because she was ready to fill in the blanks about what I had left out. And immediately in my head, I'm like, whoa. And I'm like, I'm hearing her say things. I'm like, that's not how it was. Or that's not what I meant, you know, or all this stuff. But I had this silly list, and at the step I was on was shut up, you know? So I, for whatever reason, I sat on my hands. Doesn't make any sense to help me be quiet, but I did that. And I just listened to her. What I heard was blah, 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 blah. And then it was like 20 seconds later, I start to hear like words that she's saying. And then I start to like hear the person that's saying the words, you know? And then I start to realize that like I'm staring across at this person, and it was this crazy experience. I'm looking across the table at this woman. It's like a woman that I've never seen before in my entire life. I think up until that point, I had had this like mom figure or like cartoon character, just a thing, a position in my life. But in that moment, I was quiet enough and I listened long enough. And what I saw was like a woman that was really hurt. I mean, like ripped up. And she wanted me to know that, you know, she's laying it. And I'm like, it's so heavy because I know, I mean, how did I not understand this? You know, I've been part of this whole time. And I actually experienced the hurt that she felt. And I realized that's what this process is I need to understand this harm. And then we get to that next question is, what can I do to make this right? Now, in this case, it wasn't like I had stolen money from her. I want you to pay that back. And she wanted to know that her son she's not going to get a call from a Nashville jail. You know, that I'm there. She didn't even know I was in that state. Or she wanted to know that on Thanksgiving, if I come, that I would come and that I wouldn't show up drunk. You know, she wanted a son. She wanted a son, and that's all she wanted. And so I could tell her right then, I can do that. And so I started just having calls with her to check in, making her a part of my life, a sober life. I have such a great relationship with her today that this is like 14 years past that now. And it's like, it's just an amazing gift. And again, why did I go to that first AA meeting? It was because I was running a con on my wife, trying to get her to come home. That would have been the greatest thing I could have wanted. What Alcoholics Anonymous has given me is so many millions of times greater than that, the gifts. Right, to be able to have a real relationship with a human that I'm surrounding my whole life. I didn't even think, it's like I didn't address her as a human, right? She's just a mom. And so I took all that stuff intellectually I learned in 4 and 5, and you put it into practice in 8 and 9, and I have a real spiritual change, you know. I also learned a lot about some of these harms and things that I made amends for. You know, I find out that it's not like I never do those things again. You know, in sobriety, I've screwed up. in sobriety, I've screwed up in the same ways that I screwed up before I even got here. You know, that's just been my experience. I haven't been rendered perfect. And one thing I'll share with you is that, I mean, the one thing I haven't done is had a drink of alcohol, but I screwed up in a lot of other ways. There was one time where I think it was my wife, she's getting ready to travel, go on a business trip. And whenever she's getting ready to do that, it just pisses me off because she's all focused on how big and important her job is. And she's probably not giving enough credit to all the work I'm doing in my job. And I remember she said that she had lost the charging cable for her phone and that she needed this before she got on the plane the next morning. And could I please go get it? You know, fine. I have to do everything else for this family. Why would it be a big deal that I do one more thing, right? So I go to the Best Buy to buy her this cable for her phone. And I'm already ticked off. I go in there and sure enough, I'm immediately angry once again, because if you try to go into that place, I'm not sure how it's laid out now, but it's probably the same. But like you go and you try to get like a cable for phone and you look at the signs, there are probably like four different places that you think you might need to go. It's like phones, electronics, tablets, Apple, you know, like in the back, you're like, where is this? But so now I'm ticked at the people who laid out Best Buy and they're on my nerves now. And I finally find the place that has these cables and I'm like, all right, well, you know what I'm not going to do is I'm not going to get home and have it not be the right one that doesn't fit. And she had the same phone I did. So I opened up the box and plugged it in just to make sure it would fit. And it did. And at that point, I look at the box and I see in the price is like $40 for like this little cable. And I was like, these people aren't going to get these cable people aren't going to get me now either. Like this is it. I'm not going to put up with this. So I took the cable. I already had it in my hand. I just wrapped it around my palm, put it in my pocket. I'm probably like 10 years sober at this point, sponsoring guys, you know, spiritual giant. And I put it in my pocket. And because I'm just trying to help my wife here. That's all I'm doing. And I go and I drive home. And I remember getting home and I throw the cord on the table. Here's your cord. She's like, thanks. And I remember that I didn't think anything of it right at the, like, really, I didn't really worry about it that night. And then but what I noticed is the next couple of weeks in meetings, it was like everybody was talking about conduct or honesty or stealing. And, but everything that people were sharing, it's just like, I didn't identify. I didn't, you know, I was just like, I just felt like I didn't. Wasn't connecting with it. And I knew I should tell my sponsor about it, but I was at this point where I really didn't want to tell him about it. I thought about telling him about it and I didn't want to tell him about it because I was really afraid that of really how that made me look, because I wanted him to think that I wouldn't do something like that at this point in sobriety. And that was just a little immature, unnecessary, and just shouldn't. And I was more worried about what he would think than actually telling him. So I didn't. And the result was I didn't feel connected. I felt more separate in AA and I didn't, you know. And I heard a guy sharing in a meeting about stealing in sobriety. And this guy talked about stealing baklava from like a Greek diner that he worked at. And getting caught and making amends for it. And I should tell you too, I had already made amends to Best Buy in my first set of amends from stuff that I did back before I came here. But anyway, this guy was sharing about he stole the baklava, he made amends for it. And then some time later, still at the job, he did it again. He needed to go make amends for it again. And I think what I realized in that moment is that where do I get off thinking that I am above the mistakes that I make? Why am I so special? Like, why am I so different? And why on earth would I think that the solution to this problem would be any different than the solution that has worked for me, which is I got to get honest with another alcoholic. I tell my sponsor about this and I got to make amends quickly. And so I did. I talked to my sponsor about it and I cleared the air and I made that right with the folks that I stole from and I got it all cleared up. But I share that just because it's really weird how that stuff can happen, especially when ego gets into it. And I don't know why I was off kilter, but that's what happened. And then it became very easy for me to avoid the solution that works. And what was scary about that is probably closer to a drink than any point in sobriety, because the result was I was pushing AA away. And if I'm ever in that situation, I'm getting closer to a drink. You know, and also in Alcoholics Anonymous, what I've learned here is that every time I think I know the answer, or I know what's right, or I know what's right for me, I get some kind of alert and reversal that shows me maybe I don't know what I'm thinking about. It's just like, basically this ego gets built up and then it gets burned down. And then I'm like, oh great, I'm back. I'm just an alcoholic again. And as I'm saying that, it's starting to build up again. And, you know, I just don't know what's right for me. I need you guys and I need a higher power is the answer. We had one time my home group puts on we put on every year a speakers conference. And it's a really great event because we get a lot of the new guys to help participate and everybody gets a job. And it's just really cool. We get speakers come in from out of town that we don't hear a lot. It's a really good experience. Other people from town too come in and hear the speakers. So it's a nice event. And so I remember before this event was happening that on the way to the place in the morning, I was running a little late, right? And so I looked at my watch. I don't know if I'm going to make it when I needed to be there for my commitment. And so I hopped in my car and in front of my house, I park kind of parallel right in front of my house where we live in a little neighborhood. And to get out, you actually have to go and there's a circle. You go around and then you kind of come right back out. There's a median. So I couldn't just turn left. You have to go around the circle. And so anyway, I hop in my car and there's a guy kind of coming over the hill up behind me towards me. And I won't say I cut him off, but 9 times out of 10, I wouldn't have pulled out. I would have let him go by, you know, but I was in a hurry and I was late for my commitment. So I pulled out and I zipped ahead and I go around this big circle. And as I come back, so now I'm going to go back out of the neighborhood. This guy had stopped because he knew I was going around that circle and he waited for me to come back. And he hung his arm out the window and I'm coming through and he's like, you mother, you know, just screaming, you know, hollering. And I'm thinking, wow, this guy really needs a spiritual solution. You know, I'm like, thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, to save me from this. And my tie on for my event, you know, the day of it. And I go over there and I'm joking with the guys and I'm telling them about this incident that I had and this altercation and this sicko, maybe he'll find the rooms of AA one day. And so we had a laugh about it. And then I remember I came home. It was, I guess, the afternoon at that point, tuckered out, long day, took a little nap, laid down, rest my eyes. And I'm awoken maybe an hour later. My wife is shaking my shoulder. And she said, did you see what they wrote on your car? And I'm like, what? And I jumped up immediately. And I go down and my car is parked right where it was, where I pulled out that morning. Except now on the back, you know how the dirt builds up? And sometimes people write, wash me or something. This guy wrote on my car, kids beware. Like right across the back. Like this guy's such a crazy driver. He'll just run over kids, you know, in the neighborhood. Or kids beware could mean a lot of distasteful things. The whole point was at that moment, I became so enraged. Like I could feel my chest filling up. Like I was so mad. This guy had vandalized my stuff. You know, he had messed with my property. And so I remember I'm so angry. I'm going out and I took my dog and we went on a walk because here's the thing. That was a silver 4Runner. And I know where the Silver Forerunner is in the neighborhood. And so I go marching up and down the street, and I'm looking in the window of their of the house that the Forerunner's at, and there's like a dinner party going on. There's like six people in there, but you know, have a good time. And I'm marching. The third time I go by, the shades have all been drawn. So clearly I've made a scene at this point, like stalking in front of the house. And I call a couple people in AA, and the recommendation I got, I'm gonna head on home. Why don't you go home? And I went back home, and I talked to my sponsor, prayed on it a little bit, and chilled out. And the reason I tell you all that is because I could have made a scene. I could have gone to the guy's house, and I could have let him know what's going on, because I know who did it. So next Thursday is our normal home group meeting. And, you know, I pull in there getting ready, making the coffee with the guys beforehand. And one of the newcomers, Kevin, pops up to me. He goes, "Oh, hey, Andy. Yeah, that was awesome this weekend. That was a good day event. Hey, did you see what I wrote on the back of your car?" And I was like, "Oh, my God." And then at that point, it just became kind of funny. Kevin was making a joke. He had heard me joking about the event. But do you guys see, I would have wagered everything I've ever had, everything I'm going to have, that guy did this to me, because I'm still carrying this thing that I did wrong that morning, where I put myself ahead of other people, and I'm ready to cause more damage to even people that were not involved at all, because I know the truth. Truth is, I don't know anything. I need you guys to help me see that. And I need newcomers not to ride on my car. That's trouble. And one other thing I'll share to you guys too, and I'm going to make this quick. But AA's given me so many gifts, and I'm going to tell you one thing. I have three kids now, and I my son is 12 and my daughters are 7. And I just wanted to share this experience, because I think the point of Alcoholics Anonymous has been for me is to allow me to have this relationship with a power greater than myself, you know, kind of restore me to sanity so that I can be useful to people around me. And when we're in an AA meeting, we say stuff like that, or when I'm standing at a podium and a microphone, I can say stuff like that, and it makes sense. But where does God come in when really I'm not here in this church, and I'm not on the phone with my sponsor, and trouble comes, you know? And so we had this experience. My wife was pregnant with our twins, and again, they're 7 now, and her water broke about 3 months early. It was really early. And so we had to be rushed to the ER at the hospital. And it was a very scary time. And Nick, you can kind of pick up on the severity of situations from the people that are working there, you know, and the quantity. So we're in a room, and there's like four nurses kind of hustling around. And meanwhile, I'm kind of freaking out. My wife's pretty stoic, getting centered. And I realize I'm getting more attention from the nurses than she is, you know? And at one point they said, "Sir, is there anyone you can call? If not, you know, we have people here you can talk to." And I remember thinking, oh yeah, there are people I can call, you know? And so I got centered. And what we actually found out was that this problem that she was having was, there was a man who was at the hospital, a doctor that isn't normally there, but he had been stationed there. I don't know what the term is, whatever. He's very well versed in this specific issue. He's like the expert. He's the guy. Instant relief, because I feel like we're going to be taken care of now. You know, like we've got the answer. Got the guy with the tool to fix this problem. And so now I'm centered. Now I'm squared away. I meet with the doctor. My wife and I meet with him. He comes in, and he says, "Okay, you know, here's what we're going to do. We're going to basically try not to have babies. That's what you try to do. That's all you can do." And so I'm like, I'm looking for stuff like, what am I going to do? Like, what practical thing? And I said, "Listen, man, I'm all in here. You know, I'm 100%. What can I do?" And this doctor, it's like, you know, he had whatever he had in his hand, and it's just like everything fell away. I just went, and he looked right at me. He said, "You can pray." And I remember being like, "What the F are you saying? You're the doctor. You know, we're in a hospital. This is a medical place. I'm not at the AA meeting. I'm not at church. This isn't the answer I want from you. These are my babies. You know, I was angry. And what I realized is that, like, this is the same problem as any problem ever. It is a separation from God, or it's going to be a connection with God. I have an option. I can trust in a power greater than myself and let this thing happen how it's supposed to, where I can be useful and helpful. Or I can be angry. I can throw things around a room and I can tell somebody he doesn't know what he's doing. And I can do all this stuff. And so what we did is I sat with my wife for 10 days not having babies. I act like I did anything. I didn't even sit there and read with her. She was, you know, was the patient. And it should have been the scariest and worst time, because we're talking about a life and death situation for two little babies. And fear, don't know what's going to happen. Even if these babies survive, that's where we were. If these babies survive, are they going to be healthy? Are they going to be able to live a good life, you know? And this is a fear. Those 10 days were the clearest, best days I've ever had with my wife. Because we spent all of our time together getting very clear on, like, what our purpose was. She's in another 12-step program. And so, you know, she talked to her sponsor. I talked to my sponsor, my sponsees. I said, while we're in here, I'm going to keep my commitments to my meetings. Turns out there's a meeting in the hospital I didn't even know about that I could go while I was there. I had sponsees that were, like, almost afraid to call me because they knew what I was going through. And I had to tell them, I said, you don't understand. You know, this is what I need to be doing right. You're helping me so much more than you even understand. And so we sat there together. There was nothing between me and my wife. It was clarity and it was support and it was love. It was God there. 10 days later, she gave birth to two tiny little baby girls. And they were in the NICU for like 3 months. And we were in the NICU forever. And then they got home. And I have 2 7-year-olds now that are just a pain in the ass. They are running around eating chocolate and healthy and wonderful. And what I learned from that experience was that there is no problem outside of this problem. And I want to dress everything up, if it's affecting me, as it's more complicated than God. And it's not. And that's been my experience. I'm grateful to be here. Thanks for asking me to speak.